people tell me anything. Don't take my fame. Don't take my fame. Ow. You've got no idea how bad things can get, how people treat each other when you've got no respect. I should know. I should know.
Chill in the air, the holidays near. I'm writing this letter as I do every year. And I'm doing alright, I'm carrying on. But forget about December, I'm just not that strong. And I'll need to be alone in select company. Some whiskey, a tree, and me. And I surrender my pain to the bottle. Day, the most precious little gift, return my gaze. But not 17 years, in fact less a day. Who'd dream of red flowers surrounding a grave? And every trip around the sun rewinds misery. Whiskey, a tree, and me.
whiskey, the tree, and me.
This is the 91.3 FM Business Billboard. Regina Community Radio is delighted with the support of the following businesses.
Looking for that next previously owned vehicle? Hi, Des here from Regina Auto Auction. We have a public indoor vehicle auction every Saturday at 1 p.m. sharp. But first, come on down and inspect the ever-changing selection of vehicles consigned to Saturday's auction at our sale site at Arcola and Victoria, or check them online at www.reginaautoauction.com. Buy or sell today the Regina Auto Auction way.
Are you looking for a great way to promote your business? Hi, Sean McNall here from TG Marketing. We can put your logo on just about anything, including clothing, flash drives, tote bags. The list is endless. Call us today at 586-7100 or come and browse our showroom at 1046 Winnipeg Street. And don't forget to check out our new website, tgmarketing.ca.
This has been the Business Billboard. Thank you for supporting Regina Community Radio.
I suppose you could watch the Rider game at home. Just think, you might even get some housework done between plays. Maybe some light dusting, the dishes, even some vacuuming. Or you could take a 3-hour mini vacation. No distractions, just you, the game, and endless scenery of greenery. Call 1-888-4-RIDERS or visit riderville.com. Rough Rider football. It's better in the stands.
This is the 91.3 FM CJTR Community Connection, brought to you by the Cooperators. When it comes to insurance, trust the Cooperators, connecting cooperative values to supporting communities.
Take in the Gospel Music Festival on Saturday, July 14th from 12 until 3 at Scar Street Mall in downtown Regina. Come relax and enjoy an atmosphere of gospel music. Chairs will be provided, and this is presented by Global Faith Healing Ministries. You can call them for more information at 216-0497.
If your nonprofit organization has an event Regina should know about, call us at 525-7274. Community Connection, brought to you by the Cooperators, a better place for you, connecting community needs to affordable solutions. 91.3 FM CJTR, Regina Community Radio. Our programming is made possible by community-minded businesses like Bennett Dunlop Ford and by listeners like you.
The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily shared by Radius Communications Incorporated, operators of 91.3 FM CJTR.
Dignity,
security,
freedom,
respect,
justice, equality,
remedy, and protection,
fairness,
fair time,
criticism,
right,
work,
peace,
movement,
movement.
It's my mistake. Let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
leisure,
health,
education,
culture,
human rights,
Cardano,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raised the wall, and I'm the only one.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm joined by my co-host, Halina Seiferling. Our special guest this week is Dave Mitchell, who's here to talk about Beautiful Trouble. Beautiful Trouble sounds like an oxymoron, but it is the title of a recently released book launched in Regina on June 27th. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you.
And Halina, you were here last week as a guest, this week as a host. Yeah. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
And let's find out what Beautiful Trouble is all about.
All right, yeah, so we're going to talk about this book. And I have to say, I looked through the book a little bit so far here, and it's pretty awesome. It's so this book, I'll kind of introduce it a little bit, talk about what it's sort of about, and then we'll ask Dave some questions about his contributions to the book and kind of why it is so great. So this book, on the back it says that it's an invaluable activist resource. It assembles the best ideas of 10 groundbreaking organizations and over 70 troublemakers into a set of interlocking design principles. You're supposed to use it to instigate anything from a flash mob to a revolution. So basically, it's organized in a really interesting way in that you can kind of read through it, or you can just pick and choose parts you want to look at. Each page is sort of its own aspect, and it's organized into a few sections. There's tactics, which kind of talks about really specific tactics you can use if you want to organize any sort of event. Then there's principles, which I think are really good things to remember to kind of keep in mind when you're planning these sorts of things. And then there's theories, which are kind of like, instead of reading a whole chapter in a book about something or attending a class about it, you kind of get a little blurb about some of the key theories that are behind a lot of these things, like anti-oppression or capitalism or hegemony, these sorts of things that you hear all the time and you don't really know what they mean, but you can kind of get a glimpse of it. Then there's also case studies, which tell you about different campaigns that have been launched and kind of everything that was part of that and how it was organized and how successful it was and that sort of thing. And at the end, there's a list of practitioners, as well as resources and bios and an index and all of that sort of stuff. You can kind of go through the book, the whole thing, or if you just like, well, I really want to organize this type of event, and you can just flip to that page and learn everything you need to know. And what also is really cool is that on each page, it will link you to other parts of the book as well. So it'll tell you, for example, if you're looking at a certain principle, it'll tell you tactics that use this principle. It'll tell you theories that underlie this principle. So you can kind of get all the info you need. So it's really, really quite lovely. So I really enjoy it. So we're lucky enough to have one of the contributors to the book and the co-editor. Is that right? Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Dave Mitchell is here today. Do you want to tell us maybe a little bit about the book as you see it and how you came to the idea and, yeah, how it all got started?
Sure. I think you did an excellent job of giving an overview of the book. I think, actually, that's one of the most interesting and exciting things about the whole project was the sort of that architecture we set up. We sort of developed the templates for those four different content types that you talked about, the mm-hmm. tactic pieces, the theory pieces, principles, and case studies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we wrote up a few examples and then started inviting people into the process. And we just saw it, it just kind of took off from there as people just started thinking about more and more ideas that fit into the framework. And it was amazing. We were able to draw in a really incredible collection of activists, and sometimes, you know, people who've been at this for years and, mm-hmm. you know, fairly some well-known names like Starhawk and George Monbiot and the Yes Men, mm-hmm. To name a few among the 70. Mm-hmm. And I think what was really interesting was that they found that, you know, a lot of the time, when you've been doing something for a long time, it just sort of comes intuitively. You have a sense of what will work and what won't. And that can be really hard to communicate to people who are just getting started. But what the framework allowed was it just sort of it forced people to really articulate in a very short, concise way the key, the kernel at the center of what makes something work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that in talking with a friend about this, one of the things we both agreed on was that it was almost like a decade's worth of experience in community organizing, but just crammed into one book. So you don't need to go through trial and error for 10 years or however many years to try and learn how these things work. But if you just read the book, obviously experience is still very important, but you can kind of learn what worked and what didn't. And actually, that's one of the things I really liked as well, is that this isn't just a book about different success stories, but if something didn't work, there's a section at the end of that part, and it will say, why didn't this work, or how could it have gotten better? And so it'll give you feedback on that as well, so you don't have to, you know, it's not just, oh, this is going to be so great, do this. It's, well, you have to make sure you think about this and make sure that your safety is taken into account if you're doing this. Or so I think that's really good as well, to kind of be able to learn from each other's mistakes or each other's, you know, experiences and kind of share those. So that
Definitely.
Was really cool as well. Yeah.
Yeah, we really felt that, we tried to take a constructive approach with the book, because it really, you know, there's no equation for creative activism. There's nothing that, you can't just sort of follow the same formula every time and expect to get the right results. In fact, we often sort of fall into that trap. We fall in love with the tactic, and we're like, well, we'll keep using this tactic because it worked so well at first.
Yeah, yeah.
So to say that we really tried to take a constructive tack with it and recognize that we can learn as much from our failures as we can from our successes, and just to be a little gentle with that. And, you know, one of the principles, there are so many principles that were brainstormed or started and just never quite got written up yet. We can get to a bit of the sort of ongoing process of that later. But one of the principles that we wanted to write up is fail forward, fail fast, which gets at that idea of, like, you know, we're innovating, we're all trying new things, no one has it figured out, and we're all learning together. And that the book's architecture is a bit, in a sense, it's a model for how to think through those experiments.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the other contributors to the book here as well. Mm-hmm. Because it says, you know, over 70 troublemakers and 10 organizations. So are these people all from North America, or kind of where are all these people from?
Well, mostly North America, but a number in Europe, some in South America, Canada and the U.S. The critical mass of it, really, I mean, so maybe I'll just back up and talk a bit about the process, how it all came together. Andrew Boyd, it's his vision, really, that brought this together. Mm-hmm. He's been wanting to write a book like this for a long time, and just sort of never, you know, there's always just other things going on. He's been a creative activist based in New York for a long time. And a mutual friend put us in touch when I used to edit Briar Patch magazine. And a good friend of mine, Philip Smith, who's currently finishing up the website as we speak, and has done a whole lot of work on just sort of the creating the infrastructure for this many people to work together. He's a sort of a tech wizard who managed to pull all this together. I let him know that I was looking for projects, and he's like, well, I should put you in touch with my friend Andrew, because he's been threatening to write this book forever.
Threatening.
So he sort of pulled us together, and the three of us started meeting every week, I guess late 2010 that started. And at first we were just sort of really kind of hashing out the architecture that I talked about for the book, the templates. Starting to test them out a bit, and then also just sort of, starting to look for a publisher and starting to draw in more people. And what we found was that with that architecture in place, and with a few partner organizations on board, including the Yes Men, they came on fairly early and were really excited about the project. And through their Yes Labs, have been doing a lot of work to really, just to show that the things they do are not, you know, the purview of a few, you know, brilliant activists, but, you know, that brilliance can be shared, and people can adapt it in their own circumstances. So they came on board, a few other organizations and activists, mostly through Andrew's network, but also Phillips and mine. And where it really kind of took off was we held a book sprint in New York in May of 2011, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And basically, Avaaz lent us their office for the weekend.
Oh.
And overlooking Union Square, and we locked as many people as we could into that office for the weekend and fed them. And basically, we all just wrote. And there were people sort of dialing in from other places. And mm-hmm. We were sort of like live streaming what was going on.
Oh, wow.
And after that weekend, we just found we had this critical mass of amazing material. And then it became so much easier to draw in more organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of expanded from there. So it started with that kind of pranked your activist ethic. you know, the Yes Men or, you know, Billionaires for Bush, organizations like that. And then we drew in organizations like Ruckus that are doing sort of direct action training and, you know, bringing in some of those principles into it. And then, of course, I mean, 2011 was just such an amazing year for radical social movements around the world. And there was just so much learning and innovation going on. And suddenly it just so much more seemed possible. And we saw so much, such an outpouring of creativity,
mm-hmm.
You know, including Occupy. And when that sort of took off, it's like suddenly we realized, you know, there's so much more in terms of the principles of mass movement building and, you know, consensus decision making. And it just kind of grew and grew until we just felt that we were developing this language of creative activism. And, you know, obviously it couldn't be comprehensive. We couldn't include mm-hmm. everything. And kind of drove ourselves crazy trying, but so it was an amazing process, just sort of snowballing like that.
You know, it kind of occurs to me, one of the things you hear in these various protests and all the rest of it, a little chant, this is what democracy looks like. And when you think about it, that is really what democracy looks like.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't happen at the ballot box. If it hasn't happened before you get to the ballot box, it isn't going to happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's actually one of the tactics in the book that's written up really kind of gets at that idea. It's prefigurative intervention,
mm-hmm.
which basically talks about actions where we're sort of modeling the kind of world that we want to see in the very mm-hmm. protests that we're doing. So mm-hmm. we saw this so clearly with Occupy, where mm-hmm. people
yes.
were organizing to be feeding one another and, you know, looking after one another and really just sort of creating this space outside of the sort of brutal logic of the market where people could be sharing and collaborating and working together. It's just so compelling. So, it was really nice to sort of give language to that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That's one of the things I found really interesting as well about the book is that when you see it and it's, you know, July 2012, you're sort of like, oh, of course, this book is timely. But it's funny to me that the process started so far before all that happened in 2011. So it seems kind of, I don't know, I like it that it started before. It's not like you saw these things happen and decided to respond to them. It's that this was actually already going on. And just this past year has just been amazing in terms of people kind of already taking these ideas and running with them. So,
yeah
I think that's pretty exciting, too. And I wanted to read just a little bit from the book here about the contributors, since we've been talking about kind of the variety of them here. In the introduction to the book, it's talking about how you guys, I guess, were kind of getting everybody together to collaborate. And some of the quotes that people sent, or that some of the things that people said when they couldn't meet their deadlines is really funny. And it kind of proves just how legitimate, I guess, these people are in the movement. Some of the things they would say, like, sorry, I had to shut down Wall Street with a blockade carnival while distracting the cops with 99,000 donuts for an excuse as to why you didn't get your chapter in on time, right? Or, I'll get that rewrite to you as soon as me and my 12,000 closest friends finish surrounding the White House to save the climate as we know it. Like, it's just, these are really funny, I think, examples of the things that the contributors were doing at the same time that they were trying to contribute to the book.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just think it shows kind of how these people are so in this movement and so dedicated to it. So the fact that we can pick up this book and kind of get at a little bit of pick their brains a little bit and figure out how they do what they do is, I think, really, really special. So yeah. I just like that part. It was fun.
Yeah, that was it was an amazing experience and really challenging, actually, because things were changing so fast. We were on the fly, really. We're like, can you, like, you know, Sam Corbin, can you write up this, you know, this thing that you've been doing? And she's like, you know, well, I'm facilitating Occupy Wall Street meetings until like 2 in the morning every night, and like, I'll try to fit it in. But it really just sort of added to the urgency, just sort of seeing all of these things unfold and the people who were contributing to it, just putting their ideas just out there.
Yeah, for sure. So maybe we'll just quickly talk about one of the tactics in the book here, and then I think after the break we'll talk a little bit more about some other ones. But just to give you kind of a taste of what's in the book, we'll talk about a few examples. So the first one, I really like things that are very pranksterish. I found from reading through this book, I like the ones that are very cheeky. And this is under the tactic called hoax in the first section of the book. And I liked it a lot. And it talks about how this was the Yes Men, wasn't it? Yeah, from the Yes Lab, which is a group in the United States. So it says, I'll read from you the beginning here. It says, on April 15th, 2011, when General Electric announced that the company would return its illegitimate but legal $3.2 billion tax refund and also lobby to close the sort of corporate tax loopholes that had allowed them to dodge taxes in the first place, it seemed too good to be true. When was the last time a major American corporation took such a moral leadership role? Never. The announcement was a hoax created by the tax fairness group US Uncut with some help from the Yes Lab. On this occasion, the core of the action was a simple press release that masqueraded as a real one from General Electric. An Associated Press writer, as eager as the rest of America to believe that such a thing could be true, picked it up and sent it over the wire. It only took 10 minutes to be debunked, but in the media storm it created, including a temporary $3 billion plunge in the GE stock value, which is especially cool, U.S. Uncut was able to make their point at a scale usually only granted to those who can pay for the privilege. So, yeah, I think that kind of tactic is just amazing, that you can... It seems so simple in a way, just to kind of say something that isn't true, but also with just the media storm it can create, right? Yeah. And the fact that you're, I think, it mentioned that somewhere in the book too, that people complain about the media sometimes, like, oh, they only cover the things they want to cover. I can never get media to my event, or I can never, but if you use them the way that, you know, to your advantage, and you kind of think, well, what would they want to cover? Let's do that and you know, see what happens. Yeah, I just think that was a really, really funny and really powerful thing. Yeah. So I really like that one here.
And it really exploits a vulnerability in the media, in that their news operations are horribly underfunded and understaffed, and they're desperate to grab anything that comes up that can sort of, oh, make things easier for them. Oh, here's a press release. Oh, that's interesting. Let's put that on.
Exactly. Yeah, and that, well, and I think here we sort of see in practice just sort of how the book, as you're saying, you don't really read it linearly. You sort of like leap from one piece to another. And talking about that tactic of hoax, it just, and what you're saying about, I mean, there's a principle written up in the book called do the media's job for them, which is exactly that, right? And you start seeing how these kind of ideas interrelate. There's another tactic that relates called identity correction. That really sort of takes that idea, it explores that idea also, and that in a sense, you know, a hoax like that it's a case of identity correction, where you're sort of posing as this entity, GE, to say what they should say, or what they can't say, and that just sort of exposes the ridiculousness of, the, you know. And the Yes Men have just been, you know, they're the masters of that. You know, they've just done so many amazing actions that handle that. And yeah, I mean, and it shows the power of a good story, right? I mean, the media is not, you know, we can, if we tell a better story, we can get that story out there.
And, that's true. Yeah. I think probably after the break here, we'll talk more about the Yes Men, because I really want to talk about them.
Yeah, we got about 5 more minutes before the break.
Well, then we'll talk about them now. Perfect. So, yeah, I just recently actually heard a lot about the Yes Men. I didn't really know about them before that, but I think that they are very funny. Mm-hmm. And there's a part in the book, and it talks about... I'm going to have to find it here and remember the example. But it's in the case study section, and it talks...
It's the Bhopal apology.
Yes, it's that one. Yeah. Can you maybe give us a little taste of that one here while I find it?
And I'll just quickly put in a plug. There's a couple of documentaries that the Yes Men have put together that sort of document some of these stunts and hoaxes. And just a bit of background on them. They started out, it's a couple of activists based currently in New York, Mike Bonanno and Andy Bicklebaum,
mm-hmm.
who I think their first major action, or they sort of first came to notice, they started up a prank website or an identity correction website of George W. Bush when he was running for president the first time. And just sort of like exposing, just sort of like, it looked a lot like his website, but it was just a bit more sort of like frank about what, you know, the real impacts of his policies, you know, which actually led Bush W. to complain that, you know, there should be limits to freedom, like, which was
that
great.
That is so funny.
You know, and they do things like they did a similar website for the World Trade Organization,
mm-hmm.
and sort of similarly just sort of highlighting some of the impacts of their policies. But if you looked at it quickly, you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell it from the real one.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found, to their surprise, was they started getting invited to conferences to as the World Trade Organization to speak about these things. So they started, you know, at one point in a conference in Australia, and this was actually this is featured in one of their documentaries. They sort of decided, it was the World Bank that they were invited to speak on behalf of, and they announced that, you know, they looked at the sort of the legacy of devastation and destruction that the World Bank had wrought over the past 30 years, and realized that the model was flawed, and that the World Bank needed to disband, and we needed to do this better. We needed to actually have, and it was amazing. So they were presenting this to like a whole bunch of businismen
and
women, and who were just
and no
like
one
afterwards
figured it out before they got
no,
there.
No. So they're like, you know, afterwards they're interviewing people, and people are like, yeah, you know, I think we actually do need to do a better job of addressing poverty, and in a sense, that's what they're so good at. They're just sort of showing like how the power of mm-hmm. Somebody speaking from a position of authority.
Yeah, for sure.
Know? And one of the principles that I think really gets at that, it's one of my favorites. It's use the Jedi mind trick, which is of course an allusion to Star Wars.
That is good.
So, and it just sort of gets at that, like, you know, and there's another one in there that Andy Bicklebaum wrote up called Anyone Can Act that gets at the same kind of idea. It's just to recognize that, you know, if you have the confidence and you sort of put yourself forward, you can, you know, you can get into spaces and situations that you never thought really possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the sort of that air of kind of authority can get you through doors you never thought it would.
Yeah,
and they've done amazing. They've just done amazing things with those ideas. So
yeah. And that's one of the things also that I like about the book is that it's very funny. Like it's just using very clever ways of talking about things, and it is very entertaining as well. Like talking about use the Jedi mind trick as one of the titles of a principle. Like it's very funny,
yeah.
But it also gets at what you're trying to say. So
yeah.
I think it's good that you can kind of make people smile, and because I think sometimes. And that's another thing. There's so many things I like about the book. But sometimes I think in activism, it's really easy to get frustrated and burned out. And you're just like, I can't get my point across. I can't change anything. What's going on? But it's kind of a nice, fresh take in that this book is very positive and funny. And it kind of, yeah, it makes you think about things in a very hopeful way.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and there was a quote somewhere in the book, and it said, hope is a muscle. And I really liked that.
Yeah.
Because I think that's very important.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I like that this book kind of had that happy sort of attitude and kind of a funny, cheeky theme running throughout it. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Definitely.
Yeah, we're just about ready for the break here now. And but I just wanted to say, I guess one of the things that I like about the book is that it just gives me such a sense of hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when you watch the news and you watch the performance of our government, It's so depressing what has been going, especially with their budget cuts lately, you know, and in many very various fields. They've just been devastating things that should not be touched.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not expensive, but they're just slicing and dicing them.
Mm-hmm.
And now the book sort of gives me a sense of hope that we can do something about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just maybe one quote to end the half hour with.
Yeah.
That from the book that I really like is the role of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible. And mm-hmm. I think that this is what we've seen all through 2011, and that what you're getting at in terms of what's compelling about the book is it just sort of, it just reminds us that, you know, we're not going to win just purely through being right or, you know, the strength of our argument even. It's,
mm-hmm.
It's about so much more than that. It's about pointing out the poverty of imagination of the current system and just showing how things could be so much better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, and we'll be back after this break and a little bit of music. Of course, that was Michael Franti. Hey World, one of our favorite artists.
Oh, yeah.
I like all the freaky people myself. That's my favorite. So, anyway, we are talking about Beautiful Trouble.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim. So we're talking about this book, Beautiful Trouble, which just came out recently. It was launched here in Regina June 27th, I believe.
By the way, I'm Jim Hutchings, and I'm going to try here. Helena Seiferling.
Yeah.
And yeah. Dave Mitchell.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, really happy to be here.
Mm-hmm.
This is fun.
Yeah,
I love this book.
It's a really great book. If you were listening here before the break, we were talking about how happy and positive and hopeful and funny this book is. So Dave is the co-editor of this new book and also a contributor, Beautiful Trouble, and that's what we're talking about here today. So just before the break, we were talking a little bit about the Yes Men and as kind of an example of one of the organizations that's contributed to the book and some of the really funny kind of public things that they've done. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the Bhopal example. And this was when one of the people in the Yes Men, they posed as a representative for Dow Chemical, as far as I can tell. So Dave, do you want to talk about that a little bit more, that example?
Yeah. Well, this is another example. And in a sense, I mean, one thing the Yes Men has been so good at is just sort of like setting bait or setting traps. So at some point, and in this case, so they'd set up another hoax website for Dow Chemical. And just a bit of the issue background, Dow Chemical now owns or took over Union Carbide, which is the company responsible for the Bhopal disaster, where there was a leak of toxic chemicals in a community in India. Hundreds of people were killed and injured, with many, you know, hundreds more, thousands more with long-term side effects. The Union Carbide executive responsible or deemed responsible fled the country, has never been brought to justice. The company has resisted paying, you know, they paid a very, very minimal amount of compensation. So this is, this has been a sort of struggle by activists for a number of years. So the Yes Men had set up this website at one point. It had been dormant for quite a while, but I think that I believe the 10th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster was coming up, and it was the 20th anniversary. And someone working for the BBC who was doing research on the show contacted them through that website to see if thinking they were Dow Chemical, seeing if they wanted to comment.
I love it.
Yeah. If they wanted to comment on the disaster. And they said, well, absolutely. So they said yes, as the Yes Men do. And so what they did is they went on the BBC, and you can find, if you Google Yes Men Dow apology or something to that effect, you'll find this clip, and it's pretty amazing. it's Andy Bickelbaum on the BBC, you know, apologizing and taking full responsibility on behalf of Dow Chemical for the disaster, announcing that they're setting up a fund for compensation, you know, all of these measures they're taking. And again, you know, Dow Chemical stock plummets. You know, they have to issue this clarification saying that, you know, we're not apologizing, we're not, you know. And it's great. I mean, in a sense, what they're doing in that case is illustrating, I think, one of the most elegant principles of the book, which is put your target in a decision dilemma. And a decision dilemma is where your target is left with no good option. You give them, they can respond or not respond, and in either case they're going to look bad. And you know, that's a great illustration of that. And it takes the initiative, and it gets it in the news. On the 20th anniversary, it got a lot of attention to the fact that this was an unresolved
issue. And I suppose in the end, they do have the option to do the right thing.
Exactly. And you know, and that would be great. And the fact that they don't, or that their stock plummets when they're sort of challenged to do the right thing. That's a teachable moment that says a lot about, you know, how
corporations
The logic that corporations have to follow, where it's just the bottom line. So that can be really instructive for people to sort of see that at work. So yeah, I think that's a great example of, and I think, I mean, the case studies, I find, are, in a sense, it's where the other elements of the book sort of you see them in practice.
This might have been actually the example used in the part of the book when they talk about decision dilemma, but it was another example, and I forget the woman's name, but she was a mother of an army veteran who had died, I think, in Iraq. And so what she did, I think it was when George Bush was the president, right? And so he was going on 3 weeks vacation at his ranch in Texas, if that's where his ranch is.
Crawford, Texas.
And she knew that he'd be there, so she went and camped outside his house. And she said that she wanted to talk to him. And so it was the same thing with this decision dilemma, right? Because if he agreed to talk to her and kind of, you know, hear what she had to say and have a real conversation, then that probably wouldn't look so good for him. But if he ignored her, then that also doesn't look good for him.
Exactly.
So, and I think in the end, he didn't end up talking to her, right?
That's
he didn't,
right.
He ignored.
Yeah.
But she put him in that same situation where she was there very physically and visibly, and
yeah.
he was put in that situation. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think he had said something before that about how, you know, these people have died for a noble cause, and
mm-hmm.
she just wanted to ask him a very simple question, like, well, what was the noble cause that,
yeah.
that he died for, given that, you know, the lies that had led to that war had been exposed. So yeah, that was
mm-hmm.
a real watershed moment, I think, for the anti-war movement in the U.S. and
yeah.
she really sort of galvanized a lot of attention, and
mm-hmm.
exactly by putting Bush in a decision dilemma.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also a really good example of how one person can really make a change, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of time, again, when you're trying to organize in your community or, you know, think of things like this, you kind of think, well, I'm just one person, what can I do?
Mm.
But that's just such an inspiring example of just this one woman who decides, well, I'm just going to go talk to him, like, whatever, that's the end, and goes and does it. And in a way that's, again, very, like, visible in the media and just very,
mm-hmm.
yeah, just very powerful, even if she's just the one person. So,
yeah,
I really liked that part of that example as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the theory pieces that I think mm-hmm. that also illustrates, and I think some of the, you know, if we start thinking about really successful instances of activism, a lot of them share this element. The theory piece I'm referring to is called action logic.
Mm-hmm.
And this is basically the idea that your actions should speak for themselves. They should sort of make immediate sense to the onlooker. You shouldn't need a whole bunch of theory and background and explanation to explain,
yeah.
you know, what it is you're doing. And of course, not every action we're going to undertake is going to have clear action logic, but
mm-hmm.
when it does, in a sense, it does. It, again, it's an example of doing the media's work for them,
mm-hmm.
or it sort of it takes it out of their hands a bit. Where if you're potentially dealing with hostile media, who, you know, would be pretty happy to just sort of misinterpret your, you know, oh, what are these protesters on about? You know, if a photo of what you're doing
mm-hmm.
communicates the action, then that does so much work for them. So in this case, Cindy Sheehan, you know, camped out. It was called Camp Casey. That's the name of her son who had
mm-hmm.
died in the war. This camp outside Bush's ranch where he's there on vacation. It just, it communicates everything you need to know about that situation in very
mm-hmm.
few words.
Yeah.
Or a few images.
Yeah.
One of the ones that I noticed that I thought was really good was where the tea party was dumping this chest of tea
mm-hmm.
from a ship.
Yeah.
And then, lo and behold, something happens that changes the moment that they were trying to achieve.
Yeah, this was a case. That's a great case study. And this is something that Andrew Boyd, my co-editor on the project, was directly involved with. This is it predates the current Tea Party. I think this is back in 1995. But yeah, basically, you know, some right-wing agitators, or I think they were members of Congress, were pushing for a flat tax. And what they did was they staged this media stunt where they would, as you say, dump this creative tea with basically what they were saying was, this is the tax code in this, and that, you know, this is illegitimate, so we're dumping it into the harbor, you know, in reference to the sort of, you know, classic moment of American mythology. And yeah, as you're referring to, a group called United for a Fair Economy caught wind of this action ahead of time and decided to engage in some media jacking. And media jacking is a tactic that's written up in the book where it's like you take someone else's photo op and you, you know, they do all the work of setting it up and you sort of change the narrative in some way. So what they did was, just as they're about to dump the creative tea in, the working family life raft with a family holding, you know, a doll, like, roll around and position themselves right underneath that creative tea, and they're calling up, you know, don't sink us with the sales tax, don't flatten us with the flat tax, we're the working family life raft, you know, please. And to really drive it home further, they had some identity correction there. They had some folks in suits ready to sort of rush in behind the people holding the creative tea, posing as the Rich People's Liberation Front, chanting, you know, sink them with the sales tax, flatten them with the flat tax, you know, we need more for rich people. And meanwhile, all the cameras are rolling, the media are there, and they're just eating it up. The photo of this appeared on the front page of the Boston Globe the next day. It really shifted the conversation about it. It reframed the issue, right, where
mm-hmm.
it wasn't so much about, you know, getting rid of this oppressive long tax document, it's like, well, what are the consequences of a tax that's, you know, simple and that's regressive, you know, that where poor people are paying much more of the tax burden. So, yeah, I mean, and again, that's that illustrates a lot of the ideas we've been talking about. There's action logic there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're reframing the issue. They're using humor, you know, all of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to quickly talk about, well, I want to mention one more tactic as well that I thought was really funny. Mm-hmm. And it was about the Barbie Liberation Army, if that was the name. Jim's laughing. And this was, I forget the group that put it on, but it was in 1992,
mm-hmm.
and I think Mattel is the company that does, yeah. They had put out an ad campaign with something like the Barbies were saying, like, I love to cook, or I love laundry, or something.
It was
very,
like Barbies with voice boxes.
Yeah,
they were saying, like, math is hard, and things
and these things. So obviously people were very upset about this, and so what this group did is they went, I don't know if it was nationwide or just in one store or something, but they switched the voice boxes with the Barbies and the, like, the, was it G.I. Joe? Or so that all the Barbies were saying very, like, masculine rah, things, and the G.I. Joes were saying, like, math is hard. And so then the children get these toys, and they're very confused, and it causes this really funny disturbance. So I'm not sure if you want to speak to that a little more, or we could just mention
Well, sure. And this is actually, that's an early action of Mike Bonanno, who
was in Yes Men days.
And yeah, and I think that's a really illustrative case, because that's mm-hmm. something where they really did their work ahead of time. And it was in a few stores around the country, but they managed to make it look like it was sort of all over, like where I think they had people set up to, like, scramble to the nearest store when they get a media inquiry, so they could mm-hmm. sort of, like, plant some there, so that if the reporter comes, they come and they think that they're all, like, they've all been, you know.
All been switched.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. It's just such a, like, instead of, you know, if you write, like, an opinion piece in your newspaper, or you try and get on the television or something talking about why this upsets you, which can sometimes work, obviously, but this just seems like such a, again, cheeky but also a more effective way to kind of make people stop and think about it. You don't need to argue about theory, you don't need to try and get attention, you just do something, and then people automatically get it. As you say, you don't need to explain what you're doing, people will just get it.
Exactly.
And people will just know.
And this is so illustrates one of the I keep, you know, referencing other pieces in here, but
this is
an example of an intervention at the point of assumption.
Mm-hmm.
So basically there's this idea that there are different points of intervention where we can, when we're activists, and we often just sort of keep going back to the same ones. Like, the point of decision, for instance, you know, is like the legislative buildings or city hall mm-hmm. or an international summit, where it's like we're focusing our attention on the decision makers, on that action.
Mm-hmm.
There's also point of consumption actions, which is sort of consumer boycotts and, you know, intervening at a place where a product or service is associated with an injustice. Point of destruction, that's where, you know, the environmental movement has been really effective in mm-hmm. targeting, you know, clear cuts and toxic mm-hmm. waste dumps and so on.
Yeah.
The point of production, where the labor movement often intervenes, mm-hmm. which is sort of like shutting things down in the workplace or where things are being produced to sort of put pressure on a more powerful target. And the point of assumption, which it's not the most obvious or mm-hmm. immediate, but as we see in this case, where it just sort of, like, subverts these kind of gender categories in a really humorous way,
mm-hmm.
it can be really effective, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I really like that one. So I wanted to take a second as well here and kind of talk about maybe some tactics in the book that I think Amnesty International uses a little bit, because, you know, that is kind of mm-hmm. why we're here. And I think Amnesty International Canada, maybe especially lately, they've been doing some really interesting campaigns that maybe fit in with some places in the book. So I want to talk about that a little bit. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I thought they definitely do is there is one part in the book here, and it's a principle, and it says lead with sympathetic characters. And I think Amnesty International does that a lot, clearly, mm-hmm. Because if you have a petition, you have the person's picture on it, or mm-hmm. if you have a letter writing campaign that you're doing, you have the person's mm-hmm. picture, and you hear their story, and mm-hmm. you hear about one specific case, but it kind of is representative maybe of a larger issue or, you know, a larger problem that's happening in that country or in that aspect of society or whatever. So you do mm-hmm. get that kind of immediate kind of personal connection, which I thought was really interesting. And as well, one of the things they've done recently is they had a photo campaign, kind of like a photo exhibit of pictures of their indigenous people in South America. I forget if it was Guatemala or Colombia, because they keep having campaigns for those too, and I keep getting them confused. But and they were just holding signs that said in Spanish, like, we have rights too, or different slogans that they would say. Mm-hmm. And they had this photo exhibit, I think, kind of traveling around the country, and they had it at the recent annual general meeting in Vancouver. That was a few weekends ago that I was at. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it didn't even have like a petition or anything. It's just these huge photos of these people that are just kind of looking at you and holding their sign. And so it's, again, it's very, it's a very personal connection, and you see kind of their face and their story, and you want to help them, and you can kind of see it without having to feel like there's any pressure on you to sign a petition or to do anything further, sort of. You just kind of get that immediate personal connection. So I thought that was kind of reminded me of Amnesty International when I read that little section there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was good. And there was another thing that I think is really important, maybe in terms of Amnesty International and also other things. But there's another principle in the book, and it says, choose tactics that support your strategy. Mm-hmm. I think that's very important, because as we've been talking about, there's different points of intervention, right, where you can get your point across. And also, it's important to remember, I think, that every campaign or everything that happens will be different, and so you need different strategies to kind of combat that. Exactly. So I think that's interesting. And the same way, Amnesty International doesn't just do letter writing or petitions. We have letter writing, petitions, there's social media that they do now, there's lots of kind of public demonstrations and different stuff. So I think that as well, we're trying to kind of branch out and do lots of different things depending on what is needed in that campaign. So I thought that was another tactic that addresses it very well. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just wondered, do any of these activists do anything that involves like shareholder meetings? You know, when you've got large corporations and their shares are held by the public, so all you have to do to really have a say in what the company's doing is to attend an annual general meeting. If you're a shareholder, you have the right to get up and say something. Mm-hmm. So do they take that venue very often? Or?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's such a diversity of activists who contributed to this, but there are definitely some that have been focusing on sort of shareholder activist campaigns. And I believe that one of the examples in Put Your Target in a Decision Dilemma is, I think it's from the General Electric general meeting. They staged a sort of creative disruption there, a couple of activists, where they managed to sort of like pose as, or make like, they sort of posed as the MCs of the event.
Oh, okay.
So that at a certain moment, they just sort of like took the stage and were about to introduce the president and said that, you know, they had a great announcement that he'd just sort of signed on to all of these, you know, the sort of human rights code and like all of this stuff. And then invited him out to sign this giant check. Or this giant, this pledge, right?
Yeah.
And so, and again, he's put in a decision dilemma, right? It's like either he does or he doesn't.
Right.
And so,
and how quickly can we get security here to get these guys
exactly.
out?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So funny. That's definitely a sort of, I mean, that's a great example of the point of decision where I think a lot of actions are sort of focusing their attention right now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one more thing here. Quickly, we're going to talk about a few more things. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to mention a few of the Amnesty International resources and kind of examples here. So one of the things that's very important right now for Amnesty is the Arms Trade Treaty. There's a huge campaign going on about that. And right now, this is, I think, the third day of the meetings when the world leaders have been meeting to talk about if there's an arms trade and what it's going to look like and all that sort of thing. And Amnesty International had lots of campaigns, especially with bananas, which was funny. Maybe you can tell me if you like this or not, Dave. But they were talking about how there's more regulations on bananas trading than on arms in the world, on weapons. So they had petitions you could sign and letters to send in the shape of a banana. Mm-hmm. And they had, I think, people in banana suits that were dressed up, I think in Ottawa, that were doing stuff publicly. And so they had some sort of creative campaigning happening there. Mm-hmm. And I liked that it had sort of like a very visual thing. And you're like, why is this a banana? Like, what's this about? And then you kind of are drawn in a little bit and you figure out what's going on, which is kind of cool. And if anyone wants more resources about, there's lots of social media they're doing. And you can go to ai50.ca, ai50.ca. And they have, like, like a social media action center, and there's like Facebook and Twitter and I think Foursquare and email and a few other maybe kind of venues that you can do all at once, which is kind of cool that they're utilizing all this new kind of boom in social media activism.
I think one of the things that I like about it too is that it's non-threatening. You're not threatened by a banana, so you're not going to sort of shy away, you know, and again, drawing people in.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. And taking something that seems kind of big and scary, like an arms trade and weapons, and you're like, oh my gosh, what do I do? And you make it kind of easy to comprehend when you start with a banana, because it's non-threatening. So it's pretty cool. And and then maybe speaking of websites and stuff like that, we should talk a little bit about the website for this book and kind of how people can get more information and more resources and get the book in Regina and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's actually really timely because the full website, the website of the book is at beautifultrouble.org, and you can order the book through there. You can also, if you're downtown, you can stop by the Briar Patch office. I believe they're ordering some in as well. But, through beautifultrouble.org, it's also available through Amazon, either in ebook form or print form. But also our new full website where all the content of the book is going to be available on the website. We really want to get it into people's hands. It's nice to have the book so you can just sort of like, you know, I've described it as bathroom reading for activists because there's these sort of short entries. It's just sort of, it's nice to have that to be able to pull out at a meeting or whatever. But it's, we also wanted to make it available to as many people as possible. So that website is going live very soon, within the next day or two, I believe.
Oh, wow. Very timely.
So I'd encourage you to check it out there. And that's actually a really easy way to sort of navigate through these ideas, because you can just sort of click on the related
entries
and everything.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things in the actual physical book that I didn't mention earlier was that at the end of each section, there's room for you to create your own tactic, create your own principle, your own theory, so you can add your own ideas, which I think is really lovely, so that people can actually kind of start brainstorming and jotting down some ideas and forming their own sort of opinions there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's another reason you should get the real book, I think.
Absolutely. And, that's something we're really hoping people will engage with, because we really found that, as you know, as I said earlier, half of the value of the book is what's actually in the book, and the other half is in the sort of strategic thinking process that it facilitates and enables for people. Mm-hmm. And part of that is like encouraging people to write up their own ideas, to really sort of think about, okay, if something that really is key for them as a creative activist, if they don't find it in the book, you know, then that's great that they're looking that closely, and you know, write it up. Mm-hmm. And send it in. We're hoping that the website is a place where we can continue to be generating content and, you know, starting to fill some of the gaps.
Okay, Dave, I think we're done.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
The hour goes by really quickly.
Yeah, it does.
So we're going to shut down this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."